Welcome to the Tennisworthy podcast. I'm Chris Bowers, and we're taking another look at some of the most instructive moments from the International Tennis Hall of Fame's 2024 series of in-depth interviews with tennis legends. This is a series of interviews that's run from anything between half an hour to an hour with a Hall of Famer or other big name of the sport, and you can still find them all on the Hall of Fame website. Today we're going to take some excerpts from the interviews we launched in the first half of 2024, and we're on the theme of a balanced life. How often do we hear that it's vital that young players give everything to their tennis career if they want to get to the top? Well, yes, you have to give almost everything, but we are talking about human beings here. We all need a bit of release from our main focus in life, and tennis players are no exception. Take the 1990 US Open champion and 1991 Wimbledon runner-up, Gabriella Sabatini, for example. Those 2 years, 1990 and 91, were the most prolific period of her career. And she began 1990 with a change of coach. She parted company with Angel Jimenez and hired the Brazilian Carlos Kiermaier. And the biggest thing Kiermaier brought to Sabatini's game had nothing to do with tennis.
Yeah, I think the difference is there. Carlos Kiermaier was very important in my tennis career. I think one thing that was crucial is that he tried to bring out the personal, my personal life, you know, into place. You know, like if I had a dream or I wanted to achieve something on my personal side, he encouraged me to do it. And by doing that, he took away the pressure a lot from tennis. And that's how I got into this US Open final in 1990. You know, I think I was more relaxed, more focused on the tennis, but not with that pressure that I used to feel.
How did he use the personal to take away the pressure? I mean, can you give me any examples of what
he
did?
If there were things that I like to do, for example, I don't know, just riding a horse on the beach, for example, or get into this carriage, that horse carriage that takes you to the club, you know, let's do that. Or I like to ride motorcycles, and I remember he said, let's take the motorcycle to this tournament and you know, you can ride it afterwards. I like to play some soccer, and we would play soccer before the matches, things like that.
So were you almost too professional in the time before you started working with him?
I don't know if it's too professional, but I think you only have one side of the story, you know, like you're focusing too much on the tennis, you know, and you kind of forget the personal side, which I think it's you know, in parallel, it's going also needs to, you need to put attention to that. You need to grow as a person. So I don't know, if today I have to give an advice to an athlete, I would say, don't stop doing things you like to do. On the other hand, I think it's healthy. I think it will take away the pressure on your career, and you learn something new, something different. It will be more healthy for your mind.
Did you hire Carlos because you wanted him to help you with that, or was that, did he identify that as the thing that you needed most?
No, I didn't know Carlos from before. I knew he was he used to be a great tennis player in Brazil and worldwide, but I didn't know him. And I think he discovered all those things as when he started to meet me and to get to know me. He realized that I needed to release. He needed to release a little bit of that pressure.
Great advice for young athletes from Gabriella Sabatini. Don't stop doing what you enjoy off court. And it's interesting to picture Sabatini riding a horse along a beach as an integral part of that US Open title from 1990. A lot of tennis players lose themselves in card or board games or in a book, but that's generally in the player lounge before matches. The former world number one, Jim Courier, twice a champion at the Australian and French Opens, feels his approach to music and also to learning French were very much part of his success in tennis, albeit indirectly.
When I grew up playing tennis, I also grew up playing music. My grandmother, rest her soul, bought me a drum set, and my parents allowed that to take place because this was not one of your electronic drum kits that makes no noise. This was the booming, acoustic, full set with big crash cymbals and everything. So I was always quite musical, and I loved playing music. I'm still musical to today. I have a little electronic drum set at home for my kids that I get on more than they do, and I have a bunch of guitars, and I love music. So that's another language. And I fell in love with French. Brad Stein, who was traveling with me as one of my coaches back in that time, Brad speaks French. So I started to become interested in the language. And then I made a determination after I won Roland Garros the first time that if I was ever lucky enough to win it again, I was going to try and say a few words in French. So I just bought a little book and I would study every night. It was actually one of the great things in that time period of my life when everything around me was changing, that I would just simply sit at home or in my hotel room and read a little bit of French and study it every night for 6 straight months. And then I became courageous enough to start speaking my, you know, basically kindergarten or first grade French level in public. And I love it because it's another way that your brain operates. It's another area of your brain that activates when you find yourself in another language. And I did enough of it that when I'm in France now and I speak again, that there'll be nights where I'll dream in French, and that's always so interesting when my brain converts over to that language for just, you know, even if it's only for like an hour.
Because there's a generally recognized link that the soccer players who live in a foreign country, if they learn the language, they're far more likely to succeed.
That's interesting.
And I just wonder whether you felt that it helped make you a better tennis player, not just that you had the crowd with you at Roland Garros.
I don't think that necessarily it made me a better tennis player, but I think it probably was part of the package that allowed me to play better tennis because there was a time with a lot of distraction available to me and I stayed focused on improving. And that's part of improving as a human being is to find things that you can get better on. And I was doing that while I was, you know, pursuing another dream.
Courier was talking there about the discipline of improving, regardless whether it's in tennis or something else. And that's a theme we hear so much from champions. I mean, how many times do we hear Rafael Nadal say, "I just want to get better"? And that attitude means the top players are always upping their level. Let's hear now from a player who retired at the age of 23 because she'd not so much lost the love of the game but found that other priorities in her life took on greater importance for her. Kim Clijsters won the US Open in 2005 but then quit in 2007 to start a family, only to come back as a mother in 2009 with renewed motivation and win a second US Open in only her third tournament back. Clijsters recalled that period in her interview with Brett Haber, stressing that being a top-level tennis player is about more than just hard work.
Obviously, working hard is something that is very important, but I think for professional athletes, it is important to work hard, but to work smart. And I've seen so many players, you know, even in my academy, even some, you know, players that I help out now, and they almost feel like the harder I work and the more I do, the better I will get. And it almost has the opposite effect on how they, you know, develop their game and develop their mental state of mind. And so it's, you know, for me, it was really important that when I got older to learn to switch off my tennis brain, because when you're a professional athlete, everywhere you go, everything you do, you think tennis all the time and you get confronted with it. And so to learn to switch it off has been, and then to switch it on at the right time has been the biggest. I've seen more kids get burned out. So it's about, you know, tennis is a sport where early on, everybody always asks you, your coach, your parents, it's how did that feel? How did that shot feel that you missed at the bottom of the net? Or how is that serve that where you just hit that ace? Remember how that feels. So it's really important, and I feel very lucky that I had a father who was a professional athlete, that to learn how I feel. It's the reason why I retired in 2000 and when I was 25, because I couldn't be committed anymore to the sport, to give everything that I have, to work hard, to be dedicated, and because I wanted to start a family. That was a life goal of mine as well, and I listened to that. And there's so many women, especially in that time when I came back after I had Jada, who came up to me and said, "I wish I was able to do what you did. I am so stuck with keeping track of the points that I need to defend and the prize money that I try to, you know, get to." And Yeah, and it's hard. I mean, for some to, you know, when tennis is the only thing you have, it's scary to go away from that.
Since you retired for the first time when you were quite young, you had Jada and then came back. Talk about the mindset that inspired you to come back for the first time.
So it all started. So I lost in 2009 was actually the year that I won the U.S. Open in September. But I lost my father on January 4th, and he was sick for a year. It was a very intense year where we, you know, helped. We were with him every day, and so there's life lessons that you go through that don't have anything to do with tennis, but that do change, you know, how you look at anything else that happens in your life from there onwards. And so for me, that was a huge life-changing experience. It was a negative one, but there were so many beautiful moments in that last year of my father's life as well. And so after he passed away, a few weeks later, I got a letter in the mail from Wimbledon, and they invited me to go to play at the opening of the new center court where they built the roof, and the invitation said that I would be able to play with Tim Henman against Steffi Graf and Andre Agassi. Mm. So for me, you know, Steffi and Andre were, you know, my childhood heroes. I got, you know, an Andre Agassi in the women's version, the denim skirt with the fluo kind of yellow bike pants under it. Like, those were, you know, Christmas presents in our household.
Those are cool.
And so for me, you know, going through that stage and kind of needing, after a tough year, needing some kind of excitement and some different goals, it was really, really exciting. So I committed to that and started hitting, and then the hunger to play tennis and to compete grew bigger and bigger, and kept my emotions in for a little bit. Didn't want to tell anybody, didn't want to share my thoughts, because I was just wondering, is this going to be over in 2 weeks or in a couple of weeks? And then... Yeah, I just grew stronger, told my team that I was working with before, and we decided to, and this is the crazy thing about it, we decided that the two lead-up tournaments to the U.S. Open and the U.S. Open, I was going to play three tournaments in 2009 so that I could kind of get a feel for what it's like to travel with a baby on tour and with a family and just to see what it's like. And I think not having any expectation and being so excited to go out to play again it was, yeah, I think that's the main reason why I was able to win and to hold up the trophy at the end of those 2 weeks.
And what a popular win that second US Open for Kim Clijsters was. It's strange, isn't it, that top players have to find that balance of supreme confidence and belief in themselves while at the same time keeping expectations low so they're freed up to play their best tennis. It just shows how powerful the right mindset is for the champions. And finding something to distract them in the right way for the right amount of time is clearly essential. Next time, we'll be looking at some of the history makers, the players we interviewed for the Tennis Worthy podcast, who were instrumental in tennis going open in 1968, a step which unlocked the door to the sport's remarkable growth over the past 56 years. Join us for that, but in the meantime, do tell your friends, family and other people you know that they can listen to all the interviews in full by going to tennisfame.com/podcast or by entering Tennis Worthy Podcast in the search bar of their preferred podcast platform. I'm Chris Bowers. Thanks very much for listening, and I look forward to your company next time. Bye-bye.